second day of a ceasefire between Israel and Palestinian groups is holding, following days of relentless Israeli strikes on Gaza and retaliatory attacks by Palestinians. Iran reiterates that it will continue to support Palestinians in their fight against Israel. And new footage emerges out of the fatal arrest of a black man in the U.S. state of Louisiana in 2019. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the ceasefire between Palestinian resistance movement Hamas and Israel appears to be holding for the second day, as there's no report of any incidents. Humanitarian aid, including food, medicine, and fuel, has begun arriving in Gaza. Rescue operations are also underway to help potential survivors that could still be trapped under the rubble of buildings targeted by Israeli warplanes and shelling. Thousands of displaced Palestinians have also returned to their homes. The Egypt-brokered truce ended 11 days of Israeli bombings and retaliatory Palestinian rocket fire into Israeli cities. Israeli attacks damaged critical infrastructures and thousands of homes, including several high-rise buildings in Gaza. Well, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has congratulated the Palestinian nation for their victory against Israel. Rouhani held the resistance and unity of Palestinians in the face of Israeli regime's aggression, saying their steadfastness brought them the victory. While hailing the Muslim support for Palestine, he said Palestinians' triumph is the victory for all Islamic nations. Rouhani, however, criticized Western countries and some Arab states for what he called wrong stances on the Israeli invasion, slamming them for supporting a regime which is, quote, armed to the teeth. Now, the chief commander of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps has reiterated Iran's support for Palestine after the victory of the resistance factions in the Gaza Strip against the recent Israeli aggression. Major General Hossein Salami made the remark in a telephone call with Ismail Haniyeh and Ziad al-Nakhala, leaders of Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements. Salami called the victory of the Palestinian resistance a divine miracle. He said the Israeli defeat is not only a defeat for the Zionists, but for their backers, especially the U.S. and Britain, as well as other despicable regimes that sought to normalize ties with Tel Aviv. The IRGC chief said the Palestinian victory has shown that Israel is on the verge of collapse. The Palestinian leaders, for their part, appreciated the Islamic Republic's firm stance and support for the Palestinian nation and resistance forces. The Iranians have taken to the streets for a second day in Tehran to celebrate the victory of Palestinians against the Israeli regime after a ceasefire came into effect between the two sides. Saman Kajuri brings us more.
Iranians have gathered in central Tehran on Saturday to commemorate the victory of Palestinians against Israel after a ceasefire came into force between Hamas and Israel, which ended nearly 2 weeks of violence against the Gaza Strip.
We are celebrating the victory of Palestinians against Israeli forces. Resistance forces have grown so powerful that Israel cannot drag a war for more than 10 to 15 days anymore. It cannot tolerate the resistance and solidarity of Palestinians. This is a victory for the Islamic world.
Scores of Palestinians, including women and children, have been killed and hundreds more injured in the Israeli shelling of residential areas in Gaza. The Gaza-based Hamas movement has retaliated by firing thousands of rockets targeting Israeli settlements, military sites, and occupied cities.
We have gathered here to show our solidarity with the Palestinian nation and celebrate the victory of Palestinian resistance groups against Israel. The ceasefire showed that the Israeli regime could not tolerate the attack by Hamas forces.
I have come here to announce to the world that we stand by our brothers and sisters in Palestine, and we will never forget them. This is a chance now to celebrate their victory.
Earlier on Friday, Iranians took to the streets in car convoys to celebrate the occasion. Iranian ralliers here say Palestinians will respond to Israeli weapons with rockets and not stones. However, they say awareness-raising campaigns like such demonstrations act as a powerful weapon by letting the world know about the Israeli atrocities and crimes against Palestinians.
As Israel was forced to accept the ceasefire, Palestinians believe that resistance is still the only way to put an end to Israeli violation of Palestinian rights and its atrocities in the occupied lands. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Nationwide Palestine Day protests have been held across Pakistan in solidarity with Palestinians. Demonstrations were held in Islamabad, Karachi, Lahore, and several other cities following Friday prayers. Javed Rana brings us more from Islamabad.
Anti-Israel sermons were delivered in Islamic schools across Pakistan. Tens of thousands of people came on the streets alone in Islamabad to voice their support for the Palestinian people. There were similar rallies in other major urban centers to protest over Israel's latest round of nearly 2 weeks long attacks on the Gaza Strip, which left scores of Palestinians dead, many of them women and children. Officially, Pakistan observed the Friday as a Palestinian day to express solidarity with the innocent Palestinians. On the streets, people in Pakistan rage with anger like elsewhere in the Muslim world since Israel attacked and desecrated Islam's third holiest mosque after forcible eviction of Palestinian residents in eastern Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and subsequent unilateral war it imposed on Gaza.
I want for government, he declared jihad. There is the only one solution to liberate Palestinian. It's only way jihad.
The disappointment and feeling of hopelessness among people against the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, or the OIC, are growing to a tipping point. No longer people in Pakistan seem to be taking 57-member bloc of Muslim countries as their genuine representative body. People in this protest believe that OIC's inaction has emboldened Israel's aggression upon unarmed Palestinians. Therefore, they want Pakistan and other willing Muslim countries for a joint military action against Israel. This demand was partially echoed during a recently held conference of foreign ministers of OIC, where some of the non-Arab states proposed to set up an international force of protection to prevent similar aggression by Israel in future. Not everywhere in Pakistan, the pro-Palestinian rallies were safe. At least six were killed and over a dozen others were injured after a bomb attack hit a rally in Chaman, southwest of Pakistan. Many suspect pro-Israel terrorist group behind the terror attack.
They want to prevent Pakistani public to attend these rallies. These elements, they fear that if Pakistani public attend these rallies, Pakistani government will get under pressure and they will definitely do something against Israel.
Anti-Israel sentiments run high in Pakistan, given the regime's policy of systematically killing innocent Palestinians and evicting them from their homes over the course of decades. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Afghanistan's Ministry of Defense says security forces have killed around 100 Taliban militants and injured nearly 50 of them. The Afghan army has also defused 34 improvised explosive devices belonging to the Taliban. Fighting between the two sides has recently resumed following a three-day ceasefire during the Eid al-Fitr holidays. The war-torn country has seen a rise in violence since the U.S.'s failure to fully withdraw its forces by May the 1st deadline. Earlier this week, at least 9 people were killed after a roadside bomb ripped through a vehicle in southern Helmand province. Also on May the 8th, a bomb explosion outside of a school killed 85 people, many of them schoolgirls. Now to the U.S., where at least two people have been killed and several others wounded in a shooting in the city of Minneapolis. One of those injured is in critical condition. Seven people have been treated in local hospitals with non-life-threatening injuries. The victims are all adults. The Minneapolis Police Department says there is no active threat and order has been restored to the scene and surrounding areas. It did not provide any information on suspects or the motive behind the shooting. Meanwhile, new footage has emerged of the fatal arrest of a black man in the U.S. state of Louisiana in May of 2019.
I'm scared.
49-year-old Ronald Green was punched and stunned multiple times and later left shackled face down. During his violent apprehension following a car chase, Green repeatedly pleaded with police, who left him handcuffed and unattended for more than 9 minutes. An autopsy report suggested the black man's death was partly due to physical struggle, inflicted head injury, and restraint. Green's family attorney has requested federal indictment for the officers involved in the case. Louisiana State Police are also facing criticism for their belated release of the footage showing Green's arrest. Moving on to other news, now turning to Germany, which says it will impose a 2-week quarantine on any traveler entering from Britain, even if they test negative for coronavirus. The Robert Koch Institute, a federal disease control and prevention body, made the announcement after declaring the UK a COVID risk area. It said airlines, buses, and railroad companies are not allowed to bring any passengers other than German citizens and residents from Britain. The measure comes amid warnings by German officials against the spread of an Indian variant of COVID-19 in the UK. Germany has also enlisted 11 other countries in Asia, Africa, and Latin America in the category of coronavirus high-risk zones. More than 87,000 people have so far lost their lives to the coronavirus in Germany. The country's total caseload currently stands at over 3.6 million. And now to India, where the coronavirus pandemic continues to take its toll as the country is coping with a whopping number of fatalities and infections. India reported well over 257,000 new cases on Saturday, bringing the overall caseload to nearly 26.3 million. New daily deaths also stayed at more than 4,000. Now, the total number of fatalities in the country has near 296,000. Despite the growing number of deaths, cases have seen a downward trend over the past couple of days. Amid partial or complete lockdowns in most states, India has been struggling with the health crisis since April, when a more virulent second wave of infections hit the country. Now, the vaccination process is underway, but the campaign faces major challenges due to limited supplies of doses. And the number of COVID-19 deaths in Latin America and the Caribbean has surpassed a grim milestone of 1 million. A tally based on official figures indicates that more than 90% of deaths have occurred in the region's most populous nations. They include Brazil, Mexico, Colombia, Argentina, and Peru. That account for 70% of the region's population. Over 31.5 million people have also been infected in Latin America and the Caribbean since the start of the pandemic. The Pan American Health Organization has voiced concern over the slow process of vaccinations. The organization says the pandemic is far from over, but only 3% of the region's population has been immunized so far. Now, Brazil is the hardest hit with nearly 450,000 fatalities. And the World Health Organization has once again voiced concern about coronavirus vaccine inequality in Africa, as only a small majority have received a COVID-19 jab so far.
So when we look at access to the vaccines, we see great inequalities across countries. Seychelles is one of the most vaccinated countries in the world, with 67% of the population having received at least one dose. In Morocco, they've reached 21.9%. And in Mauritius, 17%. Whereas in 14 African countries, less than 1% of the population has received a single dose, and in 4 countries, vaccination hasn't started at all.
Mashidiso Moiti said the time is running out for African countries to close the gap on vaccine inequality. She stated that the continent was expected to receive 66 million vaccine doses through the COVAX initiative from February to May. However, it only received 18.2 million doses. Moiti noted that only 2% of Africans have been vaccinated so far. That's while high-income countries have a vaccination rate of over 80%. The WHO official also called for emergency action to finance Africa's COVID-19 vaccine rollout. Political commentator Abiyomi Azikiwe says an international program is needed to carry out massive vaccinations in order to contain the spread of the coronavirus.
There's been, of course, disproportionate economic and political power. The Western countries, particularly the United States, which has been producing an enormous amount of vaccines, now have a problem of oversupply because they have not been able to convince people in certain communities, even oppressed communities, to participate in the vaccination programs. But as Dr. Masadiso Mwete, who is the regional director for the WHO in Africa, said, it's clearly something that has to be addressed. This pandemic cannot be arrested on a regional level. It has to be an international program to carry out massive vaccinations to create some type of herd immunity in order to arrest the spread of the virus. We can see that happening in some communities in the United States, but in other communities, there's still far too many cases, and people are still being hospitalized for COVID-19.
Myanmar's junta has threatened to dissolve the political party of ousted leader Aung San Suu Kyi over alleged voter fraud in the 2020 election. An official says the junta's investigation into November's election result is almost complete. They might either dissolve the party or charge party members who committed illegal activities in the vote. The military ousted Suu Kyi and took power on February the 1st, citing alleged fraud in the poll won by Suu Kyi's party in a landslide. Suu Kyi is expected to appear in court on Monday for the first time after weeks of delay with her legal case. Myanmar has been in chaos and its economy paralyzed since the coup. More than 800 people have died in the military crackdown on protesters. And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight. as the coronavirus pandemic continues to worsen in some parts of the world, the risk increases of more dangerous mutations that are vaccine resistant or too contagious to control with current vaccines. We now present you an article written by Raina McIntyre, a professor of global biosecurity and head of biosecurity program at Kirby Institute. The piece is titled Why COVID is Surging in World's Most Vaccinated Nation. The piece has appeared in the Conversation website. Archipelago nation of Seychelles, northeast of Madagascar in the Indian Ocean, has emerged as the world's most vaccinated country for COVID-19. About 71% of the population have had at least one dose of a COVID vaccine, and 62% have been fully vaccinated. Of these, 57% have received the Sinopharm vaccine and 43% AstraZeneca. Despite this, there has been a recent surge in cases, with 37% of new active cases and 20% of hospital cases being fully vaccinated. The country has had to reimpose some restrictions. But how can this be happening? There are several possible explanations. 1. The herd immunity threshold has not been reached. 62% vaccination is likely not adequate with the vaccines being used. 2. Herd immunity is unreachable due to the inadequate efficacy of the two vaccines being used. 3. Variants of the virus that escape vaccine protection are dominant in the Seychelles. 4. The B1617 Indian variant is spreading, which appears to be more infectious than other variants of the virus. And 5. Mass failures of the cold chain logistics needed to transport and storage, which rendered the vaccines ineffective. What does the country's experience teach us about variants, vaccine efficacy, and herd immunity? Let's break this down. Variants can escape vaccine protection. There are reports of the South African B1351 variant circulating in the Seychelles. This variant shows the greatest ability to escape vaccine protection of all COVID variants so far. In South Africa, one study showed AstraZeneca has 0-10% efficacy against this variant, prompting the South African government to stop using that vaccine in February. The efficacy of the Sinopharm vaccine against this variant is unknown, but laboratory studies show some reduction in protection based on blood tests, but probably some protection. However, no comprehensive surveillance exists in the country to know what proportion of cases are due to the South African variant. The UK variant, the B117, which is more contagious than the original strain, became the dominant variant in the United States. The United Kingdom has used the combination of Pfizer and AstraZeneca vaccines. More than 50% of the population have had a single dose, and also 30% of the population are fully vaccinated. But there's a current surge of cases in northwest England, with most new cases in the city of Bolton being the Indian variant of the virus. This variant is also causing outbreaks in Singapore, which had previously controlled the virus very well. Seychelles need to conduct urgent genome sequencing and surveillance to see what contribution variants of concern are making and whether the Indian variant is present in the Seychelles. If the South African variant is dominant, the country needs to use a vaccine that works well against it. Many companies are making boosters targeted to this variant. reported efficacy of Sinopharm vaccine is 79% and AstraZeneca vaccine is 62% to 70% from phase 3 clinical trials. Our research at the Kirby Institute showed that in New South Wales, Australia, using a vaccine with 90% efficacy against all infection means herd immunity could be achieved if 66% of the population was vaccinated. However, using lower efficacy vaccine means more people need to be vaccinated. If the vaccine is 60% effective, the proportion needing to be vaccinated rises to 100%. When you get an efficacy of less than 60%, herd immunity is not achievable. However, these calculations were done for the regular COVID-19 caused by the D614G variant, which dominated in 2020. This has a reproductive number of 2.5, meaning people infected with the virus on average infect 2.5 others. But the B117 variant is 43 to 90% more contagious than the D614G. So, their reproductive number may be up to 4.75. This will require higher vaccination rates to control the spread of the virus. What's more, the Indian variant, the B1617, has been estimated to be at least 50% more contagious than the B117 variant, which could take the reproductive number to over 7 and take us into uncharted territory. This could explain the catastrophic situation in India, but also raises the stakes for vaccination, as lower efficacy vaccines will not be able to contain such highly transmissible variants effectively. Herd immunity is still possible, but it depends on the efficacy of the vaccine used and the proportion of people vaccinated. A United Kingdom modelling study found using very low efficacy vaccines would result in the economy barely breaking even over 10 years, because it will fail to control transmission. On the other hand, using very highly effective vaccines would result in much better economic outcomes. As the pandemic continues to worsen in some parts of the world, the risk increases of more dangerous mutations that are vaccine resistant or too contagious to control with current vaccines. Keeping up with mutations is like whack-a-mole while the pandemic is raging. The take-home message for our pandemic exit strategy is that the sooner we get the whole world vaccinated, the sooner we will control the emergence of new variants of the virus. The World Health Organization, WHO, said on Friday, 21st of May, up to 3 times more people have died due to the pandemic than indicated by the officially reported COVID deaths. So far, more than 3.4 million deaths worldwide have officially been attributed to COVID-19 since the disease first surfaced in China in late 2019. But according to a global health statistics report from the World Health Organization, far more people have died who would otherwise not have died had it not been for the pandemic, either due to COVID or because they could not get treatment for other ailments. Samira Asma, the World Health Organization Assistant Director General in charge of data, told reporters, "Total deaths are at least 2 or 3 times higher than officially reported. In 2020, the report found there had been at least 3 million excess deaths due directly or indirectly to COVID-19, while the official number of COVID deaths was 1.8 million at the end of the year. Discrepancies due to a number of factors, including a lag in reporting on COVID deaths in a number of countries, and the fact that many people early on died of COVID without being tested. World Health Organization data analyst William Samburi told reporters, "This has resulted in many of the official COVID-19 statistics being an undercount." He said, in addition, "There are the deaths that can be attributed to the difficult conditions that many people in the world are living under because of the pandemic. Many people suffering from chronic diseases or acute illnesses other than COVID-19 have been unable to get medical treatment and access to healthcare due to the measures imposed around the world aimed at reining in the pandemic. The socio-economic toll of lockdowns and other measures has also led to significant increases in depression, and the World Health Organization said there were indications of growing suicide rates in some parts of the world. Samburi said, acknowledging that the reported COVID numbers are only a fraction of this full impact, we have been looking at the excess mortality attributable to COVID-19 for 2020. This is essentially the difference between the total number of deaths that occurred that year and the deaths that would have been expected to occur had there not been a pandemic. He said, excess mortality gives us a better picture because it captures both of these direct and indirect effects. He said it still remains unclear how many of the excess deaths counted last year could be directly attributable to COVID-19, adding that the World Health Organization was working to determine the best methods for identifying missed COVID deaths. The World Health Organization said its excess death estimates were based on data analysis where possible, but also statistical modeling due to a critical data gap in many countries, especially in terms of death registration. ASMA said, while most countries do well in registering births, only 40% of the world's nations register at least 90% of deaths that occur. And there are huge regional discrepancies. The report showed while 98% of deaths are registered in Europe, only 10% of deaths in Africa are registered each year. ASMA called on all countries to invest in scaling up their data and information systems, insisting, we can only be better prepared with better data.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today.
We've begun discussing monotheism and the divine attributes in the last few episodes. Shiite scholars believe that God is one, in contrast to other religions such as Christianity.
He's completely immaterial being.
We don't believe that in the Trinity, and that there's three dimensions to God, Holy Spirit, Jesus, and God. We don't believe that he's a physical body. Also, in contrast to other sects in Islam, within Islam, Shiism doesn't believe that God is a physical body. We believe that he has absolute power. He has absolute knowledge. Also, the verses of the Holy Quran in which physical attributes have been ascribed to God, such as having a hand, and so on and so forth, we don't take these literally. We interpret them in a different way, in contrast to other sects within Islam. This is very important, and we're going to be repeating this throughout all of our episodes. It's necessary to make this clear. So even if you see such expressions as the hand of God, it's important not to take this literally, because God doesn't have human-like characteristics such as a physical body.
Today we're going to be examining a problem which is very important, very significant. That problem is this. We see that in the books of Islamic doctrine, even the very basic books of Islamic doctrine, we see that in the discussion on God and his attributes and his beautiful names, we see that in one division, God's attributes are divided into negative attributes and positive attributes. By negative attributes, of course, they mean those attributes which are indicate the negation of an imperfection from God, regardless of what that imperfection is. These negative attributes are in turn divided into various names and various attributes, such as the idea that God doesn't have a partner, he doesn't have parts, he doesn't have attributes which are external to his essence, he doesn't have a partner in creation, and He doesn't exist in a place. He doesn't exist in a body. He's not connected to a body, and so on and so forth. The idea that we want to talk about today is this. One of the negative attributes of God is the idea that he doesn't exist within something. Like, for example, like a color would exist in a body, or a smell would exist in a body, or even knowledge would exist in the soul. He doesn't exist in such a way. The question that we want to address today is, why is this? What's the reason for this? Is there a reason for this? Or how can we explain this? The answer to this question is that when we examine such properties which exist in certain other things, we see that the common distinction of such things is that they depend on the things in which they exist, right? They're subordinate to them. So, like, for example, let's say the color of an apple that exists in this apple is dependent on the apple in its existence. If the apple were to cease to exist, if it were to rot away and be destroyed, the color would also be destroyed. If you take this apple and you throw it in the air, the color follows it wherever the apple goes. So it's subordinate to it. It's dependent on it in its existence and its subsistence. At the same time, we know that God Almighty is not subordinate to anything, and he doesn't depend on anything in his existence. So therefore, he can't exist in anything in such a way. And now a question arises, and that's this. Sometimes we read certain traditions in which God says that which imply that God is in the heart of the believer. He exists within our hearts, or مثلاً, his presence is felt in a certain place, and so on and so forth. The question arises then, if God doesn't exist in something in this way, and it's impossible for him to be so, what exactly do these traditions imply, or what exactly do these verses of the Holy Quran imply? With the reservation that this is something that should be taken up in the science of hadith and tradition, and the science of the commentary of the Holy Quran, we know that we can say, and also that these traditions should be examined based on the explanations that were given regarding them from the family of the Holy Prophet. Nevertheless, we can, based on what we know from these explanations, we can say that these traditions don't want to negate what we've just affirmed, that God doesn't exist in a certain place. Rather, they imply a certain spiritual connection, not physical connection, a certain spiritual connection that exists between a believer and God, and therefore doesn't contradict what we just talked about. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We're examining the impossibility of God existing within something else. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Aga, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The 13th presidential election. Iran's 13th presidential election is going to be held on 18th of June. On that day, the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran will be elected through the direct vote of the people. In view of this and the importance of election in the Islamic Republic of Iran's system of government, we have devoted a number of programs to this issue, and we will deal with it in detail to review the electoral system in Iran and the status of elections in the Islamic Republic of Iran's constitution. Elections in Iran is one of the most important pillars of religious popular rule. This importance stems from the determining role of people's vote in the elections, which paves the way for serious competition and for factional politics. In less than 1 month, the 13th presidential election in Iran will be held, and the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran will be elected to office. The previous round of the presidential election was held 4 years ago. Concurrent with this important election, the 6th round of municipal and local elections, the city and village council elections, will also be held in Iran. Elections, especially presidential election, is one of the most important events in which people's direct participation and people's turnout is the all-decisive. This election, due to the position of the president in the political system of Iran and the authority invested in the president, has a very special importance. Naturally, the president is the head of the executive branch of the government. His duties and responsibilities are quite considerable. In the Islamic Republic system, there is often a division of branches of the executive branch of the government, which is independent from the other two branches, the legislative and the judicial branches. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has emphasized on many occasions the importance of presidential elections in Iran. For example, in 2013, the leader called holding the election as one of the honors of the Iranian nation. The leader said, "The day in which there was talk of election, since the beginning of the constitutional movement till the era of the Islamic Republic, before that such words were meaningless in the true sense of the word. A real nationwide election had not occurred in Iran. Even during the national movement period, although there was a real election, it was below the dignity of the Iranian nation, so that people would turn out from the remote villages to vote at ballot boxes, recognize the candidates themselves, know themselves, vote themselves. This took place only in the Islamic Republic, and our great Imam was the innovator, designer, and engineer of this structure. From the very beginning, he insisted that a referendum should be held as soon as possible to determine the ruling system. As in the revolutions in the world, such work take place after 3 years, 3, 4, or 5 years, or even more. But in the Islamic Republic, the referendum took place within less than 50 days after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. And that massive and great number, with such a high proportion, came to the ballot box and voted for the Islamic Republic. That what they voted in is the second issue. The first issue is that people showed that their entire being, that they are present in the arena and are ready for undertaking decision-making and determining the future of the country. The ground for this was set and founded from there and then, and we continue to this day. On the occasion of the 25th anniversary of the passing away of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "In the model of the Islamic Republic, not only the popular rule and religion are not separated from each other, but also popular rule stems from religion. Let not some people think that our great Imam adopted election from the Western culture and mixed it with Islamic thought and Islamic law. No, if election and popular rule and relying on people's vote had not been part of religion and had not been learnt from Islamic laws, the Imam would not have had any commitment." That frank and decisive person expressed the issue. This is part of our religion. The Islamic law should be observed. And the management affairs in this system is done by popular rule. And that relies on people's vote. This is the main pillar of the Great Imam's movement. And again, the leader of the Islamic Revolution in March of 2013 said, "When you choose the president, it means that you put all the executive tracks of the country in the hands of a person who is elected by the people and rises from your vote and your will. When you choose the members of parliament, it means that you cede legislation and also supervision of the executive branch to the people that you have chosen, and they have been duly elected to office. Therefore, it is you, the people, who choose. This means people's power in administration of the country's affairs and people's control over the country's fate. This is not a trivial matter or a small thing. This means everything to us." In a democratic society, it is the voters who elect qualified persons and officials for a specific post by using their votes. Article 56 of Iran's constitution has recognized the right to determine the fate of the source of political authority. Moreover, other articles of the constitution have expressed the method of exercising this right and the tools for putting the votes into practice. Article 6 of the Constitution stresses that in the Islamic Republic of Iran, the administration of affairs of the country is dependent on public vote. Political analyst Saleh Iskandari says, "President who is elected with the direct votes of the people and as the second most powerful person in the country takes over the administrative and executive affairs of the country, enjoys extraordinary high power in that all facilities, resources, authorities, duties, and legal rights have been considered in the Constitution in proportion with this position." Well, dear listeners, political experts and academics maintain that republicanism is the best form of government. The most important political achievement of the Islamic Revolution has been the foundation of the Islamic Republic of Iran government. Because popular power, republicanism, is combined in this system with divine rule, or Islam. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. In continuing our discussion on the beautiful and profound tradition of Imam Sadiq عليه السلام, in which he mentions to us in a type of bullet point form the battalions of the armies of the intellect and the battalions of the armies of ignorance, basically the junood of the aql and the junood of the jahl. And we have now reached the 21st segment of this tradition, where the Imam now mentions two very important points. And this can be seen also in the tradition that we mentioned from Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Another very beautiful tradition we mentioned, in which he, you know, dictates to his companion Hisham. And we, alhamdulillah, had the ability to discuss the tradition in our previous segments and episodes. In this segment, the Imam says again two very important points. Again, they have extreme practical implications and they lead to other things. The first one the Imam mentions is samt, or silence. Now again, it's not just being quiet. Samt here is that quietness in which a person is not alone, but rather he is in solitude within himself with his Lord. That he's able to hear himself communicate with his Lord. Rather, he has the ability to hear his own consciousness, his own soul. For the natural inclination of the soul is to go back to its source, which is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Now the soul will want to go back to its primordial soul and its primordial source rather. So when a person is silent, that ability for the soul to reconnect with its source is there. On the other hand, when a person is so talkative, when a person is garrul, and he has this garrulness, he just talks so much and it's so much irrelevant speech. Islam does not deny a person speech, no, but speak, you know, with a hadaf, with an objective. Don't just randomly speak about things that, you know, or, for example, Islam does not say don't joke, but there's a type of joke that you can say, and there's the amount of jokes that you can do, and to who you can joke with. So these are certain things, you know, that are important for us to understand, that, you know, just because the hadith has some, does not mean that you need to be dumb and keep quiet. No, dumb in that sense that you can't speak, but rather that, no, you have to speak, but with an objective in mind, with a purpose, you know. And people should understand that this person, when he speaks wisdom. Again, that samt, as we saw in other traditions, brings about that wisdom, brings about iman. Why? Because a person is reconnecting. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to reconnect and enable us to speak only when needed and in a proper way. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no
The debate.
Hello and welcome to the debate. A ceasefire between